This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Warnings of potential famine in Somalia grew louder after the government reported 110 people dead in a 48-hour period. The drought is affecting the East Africa region, but some aid groups say ongoing conflict in Somalia has left it more vulnerable as long-term resilience programs are more challenging to properly implement there.
That's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details next. Also, United Nations Security Council ambassadors visit the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency in Maiduguri, Nigeria. And doctors at state hospitals in Zimbabwe have ended their three-week-old strike. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a delegation of United Nations Security Council ambassadors went to the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency on Sunday, visiting displaced people in a camp in Maiduguri, Nigeria. VOA's Margaret Bashir is traveling with a delegation and has this report.
The ambassadors have been on a four-day trip to the Lake Chad Basin, going to Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. On Sunday, they arrived under heavy security in Maiduguri, which had seen its latest suicide attack by Boko Haram just 2 days earlier. Three bombers blew themselves up Friday outside a gasoline station, killing themselves but not hurting any civilians. The diplomats met with women living in an IDP camp that houses about 7,000 people and heard their stories of being widowed, terrorized, and abused by the terrorists who have been waging an insurgency in northeast Nigeria since 2009. Deputy U.S. United Nations Ambassador Michelle Sisson, the only female envoy in the delegation, has been a vocal advocate for the protection and empowerment of women and girls in the Lake Chad Basin during the Council's mission.
And I'm coming away with just two words in my brain: protection and access. Protection, because I'm hearing stories not only of these families and these women who have been victimized, their children victimized by Boko Haram, but then the protection needs, especially of the women and girls, not only inside the camp, but also if they have to go outside either for firewood or to seek some sort of income-generating activity.
Ambassador Sisson said the access issue is related to aid deliveries. The UN says some 700,000 people in eight local government areas are still inaccessible to humanitarians. More than 5 million people are food insecure in parts of the Northeast. At the IDP camp, many residents, like this woman, said aid distribution is not enough to feed their large families.
We are suffering from hunger. Our children are dying for not to suffer for that. Sometimes, at the end of the month, sometimes I don't have food. I will manage to go and beg small.
The United Nations has warned that about 2 million people in parts of the Northeast could face famine conditions in the coming months if donors do not step up. Peter Lundberg is the UN Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator for Northeast Nigeria.
There is no famine right now in the Northeast, but we are really, really playing with the fire unless we continue to ensure that these people are getting steady assistance on a regular basis. And it is a struggle. Right now, the food operations here cost $1 million per day.
He said countries need to quickly follow through on their pledges from last month's humanitarian summit in Oslo, which raised more than $450 million for this year to help affected populations in the Lake Chad Basin. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Warning of potential famine in Somalia grow louder after the government reported 110 people dead in a 48-hour period. The drought is affecting the East Africa region, but some aid groups say ongoing conflict in Somalia has left it more vulnerable as long-term resilience programs are more challenging to properly implement. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more.
This is not Somalia's first drought, and it likely won't be its last. Saturday's announcement of the deaths of 110 people in just a two-day period highlights the need for not just rapid emergency response to this crisis, but also long-term solutions to prevent food insecurity. Drought isn't Somalia's only challenge, says Daniel O'Malley, deputy head of the Somalia delegation for the International Committee of the Red Cross, who argues that Kenya and Ethiopia are also suffering from drought. But in those countries, there is a sort of social safety net.
I mean, it's a country which is in conflict. It's a country where we have intra-clan conflict. We've had conflict between different regions. And obviously, we cannot forget that, especially in the center and the south of the conflict, we have a big presence of non-state actors, which do have an influence on the possibility of thinking about longer term projects or development sort of kind of schemes. No?
Hassan Noor Sadi is the country director for the Somalia office of Save the Children. He also argues that Ethiopia's drought last year affected almost 20 million people, but they've fared much better because a lot of resilience work had been taking place under a certain level of stability, which has not been the case in Somalia.
So with the current level of instability in terms of conflict and in terms of social services that are available, any resilience work can be quite challenging. But I also would not want to completely say that it would not matter, because in last 5-6 years, a lot of resilience work has been done in Somalia. And that work has allowed the populations to withstand at least the medium-sized shocks.
Mercy Corps' Regional Program Director for East and Southern Africa, Darius Radcliffe, says he agrees that resilience programs work best when there isn't conflict, but says that doesn't mean they don't work when there is. And he adds, not all of Somalia is conflict-ridden.
Well, all of Somalia isn't under the control of al-Shabaab, so there's definitely a lot of pockets of areas are somewhat stable. These are areas that you could work in, and you could apply those resilience approaches.
The ICRC, Save the Children, and Mercy Corps are all working in Somalia on various projects involving livelihoods, water, irrigation, health, and education, among others. O'Malley from ICRC says his organization is trying to bring livelihood standards to at least pre-conflict levels. So far, famine has been declared in parts of South Sudan only, but the World Food Program has projected that 20 million people are at risk of dying from starvation in the next 6 months in South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and northern Nigeria. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Winter rescue operations continue on the Mediterranean as migrants continue to try to reach Italy. Many migrants were rescued off the coast of Libya this weekend. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Well, concern about 5 people who remained missing on Sunday after scores of immigrants were rescued over the weekend and last week in treacherous waters off the coast of Libya. About 122 migrants were saved from one particular vessel when they were spotted by a Spanish organisation, and this Spanish boat brought the migrants to the island of Lampedusa. But we've seen around 2,000 migrants saved just on Thursday and Friday, so really record numbers in the last week being rescued in the Mediterranean and brought to Italy.
Now, I understand the Italian Coast Guard has totaled up the number of rescues so far this year. What's the figure?
Well, the Italian Coast Guard says the number of migrants saved in rescue operations so far has exceeded 15,000, which is quite phenomenal. And the United Nations Refugee Agency estimates that around 440 people have lost their lives trying to make that crossing from Libya to Italy since the beginning of this year.
Now, we also have a story from southern Italy at a migrant camp there where a fire has tragically claimed some lives. Tell us about that.
Last week, 2 Mali nationals lost their lives in a fire in a migrant camp known as the Gran Ghetto, the Big Ghetto, which sits in the countryside near Foggia in the southern region of Puglia, close to the Adriatic coast. Now, this fire is believed to have been deliberately lit after police moved in on this operation, trying to remove the migrants and move them elsewhere. Now, the victims were identified as Mamadou Konate, a 33-year-old, and Nuhu Dumbia, 36, both from Mali. Hundreds of migrants were living in this camp, working as farm workers. Now, this camp has been established for around 20 years, and many of them just earn a few euros a day for backbreaking work, picking tomatoes and working in the fields. Police and firefighters moved in on this area because it's been the subject of a judicial probe into alleged criminal infiltration of this area. So a tragedy there, and around 300 migrants have been transferred to other buildings in that region.
And Josefina, I understand that Italian authorities have arrested more suspected people smugglers.
Yes, as we know, there's been a lot of concern about the people smugglers, some who are concealing themselves on the vessels that are departing from Libya and crossing the Mediterranean. Today, when one of the ships landed in Pozzallo in Sicily, police moved in and arrested a 24-year-old man from Cameroon and a 20-year-old from Gambia. They are accused of alleged people trafficking on one of the vessels that was carrying more than 500 migrants.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. United Nations Security Council ambassadors visit the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency in Maiduguri, Nigeria. Warnings of potential famine in Somalia grow louder after the government reported 110 people dead in a 48-hour period. And many migrants were rescued off the coast of Libya this weekend. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In Zimbabwe, doctors at State Hospital have ended their three-week-old strike. They say they're going back to work on compassionate grounds. AFP reports quotes the president of the Hospital Doctors Association, Edgar Munusi, as saying, "All doctors are back at work." The doctors had demanded higher allowances and job security for junior doctors. The state-owned Herald newspaper reports some allowances have been increased. AFP says state-run hospitals serve most Zimbabweans who cannot afford to go to private hospitals. In related news, a strike planned for today by public health workers over pay and delayed bonuses have been postponed. South Africa is experiencing an invasion of fall army worms that are damaging or destroying thousands of hectares of maize and other cereal crops. Among the hardest hit countries are Zambia, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, where the country's annual harvest has been threatened. Reporter Kudzana Vashi has this report.
The infestation has put at risk the harvest of many countries. Among the cereal crops affected are maize, wheat, millet, and rice. In January, the government of Malawi said that nearly 90,000 hectares of maize fields have been hit. And in Zambia, where the worms destroyed most maize and food crops in 2013, President Edgar Lungu ordered the National Army to help deal with the menace. Dr. David Piri is the sub-regional coordinator for Southern Africa for UN Food and Agriculture Organization.
With respect to the fall armyworm, it is a new pest in Southern Africa. For the first time, it is now in at least 7 countries in Southern Africa. What concerns us is the speed at which this pest is spreading.
Among those hit hardest by the worm are Zambia, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. Shingirai Nyamutukwa is acting head at the Plant Protection Research Institute, which is under Zimbabwe's Ministry of Agriculture.
This pest that we are talking of, the fall armyworm, we started receiving reports last year in 2016, around September. As time went on, reports of outbreaks were being reported depending on when farmers were growing their maize crops, but starting with irrigated maize in Matabele North. Now, as we speak, this pest is present in all provinces.
Jeremiah Tevera is also surprised at the spread of the pest. He is the director of the Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union.
Most farmers did not realize the threat of this worm because it's something which is new. It started very early when the crop was very young, unlike the normal stalk borer which we are experienced to.
Nyamutukwa echoes Tevera's sentiments.
When people were told that this is armyworm, they thought it's like the ordinary African armyworm, where you could just spray.
The worms were spotted in West Africa last year. Some say they may have come from the Americas along with maize imports. The pests bore into the stems of plants, but also eat large parts of the leaves as well. They are called armyworms because after attacking one crop, they move together to the next. Some say the pesticides used against them in North and South America are no longer effective. The Zimbabwe Farmers Union told the international news agency, Deutsche Welle, that there has been a lack of information on how to get rid of the pests. Zimbabwe farmer Francis Mukusha says there should be a wide-scale effort to bring the worms under control.
Government is too slow in taking action. I think one of the most important things to actually focus on is the fact that not only government is responsible, but there should be certain actions that farmers should be able to do for themselves.
The government, on the other hand, defends its actions in helping farmers fight the pests. In February, government officials told Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation that positive progress had been made in fighting the worm in Mashonaland West and Central provinces, as well as sections of Masvingo and Midlands. Shingirai Nyamutukwa explains.
We have also, as a government, distributed chemicals to all provinces, and we have been distributing chemicals like Kabaril, Super Dash, Lambda, Tide Plus for the management of the caterpillars. We have also even distributed knapsack sprayers and protective clothing to capacitate all the provinces in terms of controlling this pest. We have also printed a lot of awareness material that we have distributed throughout the country so that we at least reach every stakeholder.
Tevera says the armyworm will likely affect a government-funded program that was helping farmers grow up to 2.2 million metric tons of maize.
Some of the farmers which we have interacted with are actually experiencing between 30 to 40% crop loss. This is going to have a very big impact on the total crop from the Command Agriculture Program. But currently, we cannot quantify because we are still waiting for the crop assessment conducted by government with the help of FAO for them to come up with the official figures.
The government has not yet ascertained the impact of the armyworm on the overall yield, but Nyamutukwa says they are winning the fight. Agriculturalists say final yields will not be determined only by the armyworms. Heavy rains coupled by a shortage of ammonium nitrate fertilizer months ago will also have an impact. Farmers have already started harvesting the bulk of the irrigated early crops. This is Kudzai Zinawashe reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
The head of the UN-backed Government of National Accord in Libya, Faiz al-Sarj, visited Moscow last week. He was seeking a Russian mediation to help end the country's political crisis. Among those watching developments in Libya is Ambassador David Mack, Middle East Institute scholar and former Deputy Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for Near East. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about why the Libyan leader went to Moscow and not to Washington.
Oh, I think that Prime Minister Sarraj is using all the available international tools. The Russian government agreed with the other governments on the Security Council to set up the Libyan political process that led to the establishment in Tripoli of a government of national accord under Sarraj. Since then, however, there have been indications that the Russians might be undermining that agreement by backing a faction under General Khalifa Haftar in eastern Libya. The Russians have basically denied this, but it's understandable that the Libyans might want to make sure that the Russians stay within the international consensus.
But is Washington interested in a role in Libya?
Well, Washington is playing a role in Libya. We are very active in dealing with the government of national accord and supporting the international consensus. As with many other foreign policy issues, there has been a bit of a discontinuity in U.S. foreign policy because of the change of administrations. But I've seen no indication at all from the incoming Trump administration that they're going to end this policy of supporting the government of national accord.
But could Moscow pressure General Haftar to negotiate a political deal with Sarraj instead of his militaristic approach?
Well, I think that would be wise. There's obviously a need for more than one leader in order to bring the various Libyan factions into an inclusive government. It's not going to be possible for President Sarraj to be a dictator for all of Libya, nor would it be possible for General Haftar to fill that role. There has to be an inclusive government that includes roles for various leaders that would satisfy the population, not just in eastern Libya, but also in Tripoli, in Misrata, in Zintan, the other areas where there are strong local solidarity in favor of maintaining a degree of independence from some kind of central authority figure such as Gaddafi represented.
Final question. What's your assessment of any prospect for ending the civil war in Libya?
It's certainly within the scope of what Libyan political leaders could accomplish. Unlike Syria and Iraq and Yemen, for example, Libya does not have deep ethnic and sectarian divisions. It's more a question of competition among various political and military leaders. What is required is active diplomacy in an effort to have an inclusive government. The first obligation, of course, is upon the Libyans, but there's also an obligation on members of the international community not to undermine such efforts.
Ambassador David Mack is a Middle East Institute scholar and former Deputy Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for Near East. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou takes a look at pediatric cancer, a diagnosis that turns the lives of the entire family upside down. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss International Women's Day. It's also known as the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. celebrating women's achievements throughout history. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC. See.